box jumps are a really, really good one. So standing on the ground and jumping up onto a box, and then a depth drop, jumping off of the box, landing in a squat and jumping back up. Those are all really great examples of plyometrics that we're probably not doing as much in racing season, that are a great way to keep up our fitness and really help that elasticity over time in the winter that our bodies are going to have to take time to adapt to.
Welcome back to the Virtern podcast, Running Long. I'm your host, Francesco Puppi. I'm a professional athlete for Nike and also a Virtern coach. I got in touch with Lauren Klein after reading an article called Moving Forward Faster, How Biomechanics Influence Running Economy on Free Trail, which caught my attention a few weeks ago. Lauren has an undergraduate degree in athletic training, a master's degree in exercise science, and she's worked in the sports medicine field. So she's got great credentials and experience to apply to the trail and ultra running community. I reached out to her and we decided to dive deeper into the topic of running economy and biomechanics and how that influences our training. I definitely learned something through this conversation with Lauren, and I hope you will too, so that you can maybe apply some new ideas and tips to your own training. For those who are new here, Virtrun is the number one app for trail and ultramarathon runners of all levels. Our mission is to make trail running accessible to everybody, everywhere, through affordable coaching. This is why all our coaching plans cost $25 a month. With your Virtrun subscription, you will get a personal coach who checks in with you each week to answer your questions, adjust your training plan, and keep you accountable and inspired. For those of you who want to give training with Virtrun a try, you can take 30% off your first month of training using the code RUNNINGLONG30. So here we go, Lauren Klein. Lauren Klein, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, thanks for being with us today. So maybe before we dive into our conversation, can you give our audience a short introduction of who you are, maybe your experience as a runner and some of your studies?
Sure. Yeah. My name is Lauren. I am relatively new to the ultra running scene. I started running when I was younger, but was injured for a long time. So kind of just got out of those injuries and got healthy and got to really join the full trail and ultra running scene earlier this year. So I'm really, really excited to be able to be part of that community. But I have an undergraduate degree in athletic training, and I have worked in sports medicine the last 6 years. I have a master's degree in exercise science. I'm a certified and licensed athletic trainer, and I'm also a certified exercise specialist. So I have lots of these credentials to kind of help me use my sports medicine background and apply it into this new community of trail and ultra running.
Awesome. That's super interesting. And this is why I really wanted to have you on the podcast. Actually, you caught my attention when I, you know, as an avid reader of Free Trail, there was an article which got my attention a few weeks ago, which is called Moving Forward Faster, How Biomechanics Influence Running Economy, which I think is a topic we don't discuss as much as we could or should, because we think about training and running a lot. We're constantly striving to be better, to run farther, to run more elevation and improve our weekly volume, improve our intensity and such. But besides our training and the workouts we're doing, the stimuli we're giving our bodies, it's also important to pay attention to how our body is moving when we run. And this is biomechanics. Right. So the main question that basically introduces the article is your running form holding you back or propelling you forward? And I think it's an interesting perspective to look at running, even because running economy is like one of the three cornerstones of physiological performance in distance running, besides lactate threshold and VO2 max. So I was very interested to chat about this topic with you. So can you maybe, as a start, can you explain the concept of running economy in more detail?
Absolutely. So a lot of us know about VO2 max and how VO2 max is a good benchmark of fitness for people who are trying to do typically shorter distance running and activities like that. But running economy is more a measure of the uptake of oxygen required to be able to perform at a given submaximal speed. So when it comes to trail running and ultra running, we're typically not going at our maximal speed. So a lot of us, we're not going to hit that VO2 max while we're doing these activities. And so running economy is a better predictor of performance with ultra running. There was actually some studies showing that people who have similar VO2 maxes can have differences of up to 30% in their running economy. And so it's a better measure of performance for the activities that we're looking at.
Cool. And maybe just in short, give us a brief definition of VO2 max and lactate threshold, which are, as I mentioned, the three main variables of physiological performance in endurance sports.
Sure. VO2 max is the maximal amount of like the volume of oxygen that someone's body is able to uptake at any given point in time. So at our maximal like volitional exhaustion, right? So we get to a point where we are working so hard, so fast that we have to force ourselves to stop and we consciously make that decision to stop. Whatever our oxygen uptake is at that point in time, that is our VO2 max. Lactate threshold is kind of the point at which we've gone so far, so fast, or worked so hard that our body is actually, our muscles are starting to feel that fatigue. And so our muscles are working harder to get rid of the fatigue than they are to push us forward.
Good. And why is it that running economy is a better predictor of performance in ultra running?
In ultra running, energy cost is what we're looking at the most. We talk a lot about in training, especially time on feet. So we're not talking about miles run. We're not talking about how long or how far we run. We're talking about how long we're going for, not necessarily how fast or slow, but just the time that we're spending on our feet, on the trails, on the roads, whatever we're working towards, because we're trying to just increase the time we're able to be out there and decrease the amount of energy it takes for us to be out there that long. So we're focusing on the cost of energy it takes for us to be able to achieve those goals.
Great. And what are the factors that influence or limit our running economy?
Sure. So there's a lot more to it than just the biomechanics. There's all of our physiological aspects, there's anthropometric aspects, so body mass, body weight, and then biomechanics is just, it's the most important one. It's the most significant thing that we can modify the most to be able to improve our running economy, which is why I wrote this article on it, is it was the most interesting aspect that we can actually modify and improve our running economy through. So when it comes to the biomechanics, the main things that we're looking at are stride angle, foot strike pattern, stride length, and ground contact time. So in those different phases of the running gait, we're looking at swing time and we're looking at stance time and how fast or slow we, or how long or how short we stay in those two phases and how those two different things affect our running economy overall.
Yeah. So you mentioned basically that there are some genetic aspects that influence our running economy that are beyond our control, such as maybe our height or the length of our legs or our foot structure or percentage of fast and slow twitch muscle fibers. But as you mentioned, there are range of factors which we can influence, and we can train. So it's on these variables that we want to expand a little bit more. Can you maybe talk about in more in detail about what you mentioned, the stride angle, the ground contact time, and the vertical oscillation, and how do they play a role in our running biomechanics?
Sure. Yeah. So stride angle is defined as the When we're running, we have these phases. We have one called toe off, where it's our back leg comes off the ground. The angle that our foot comes off the ground at and the ground itself, the angle formed by those two lines is what we call stride angle. And so a lower stride angle is when someone's foot stays closer to the ground and staying more horizontal. And a higher stride angle is when someone's foot comes higher off the ground, which is a higher stride angle. And like you mentioned, vertical oscillation, it's typical that people who have higher vertical oscillation, we are spending more time fighting against gravity, trying to go up than we are trying to move forward. And so it was thought originally, the hypothesis was that a higher stride angle would lead to higher vertical oscillations and therefore worse running economy. But it was actually found that a higher stride angle is correlated with a better running economy because of its effect on other factors.
Okay.
So a higher stride angle typically leads to a decreased ground contact time. So the higher we lift our foot, our knee, our hip off the ground, the faster we get our foot off the ground on that next phase. And so that is what has been found to lead to a better running economy, is a higher stride angle, get your foot off the ground faster, and then we're running more biomechanically efficient.
Yeah. And how much can we realistically expect to improve this factor? For example, looking at ground contact time, are we talking about just a few point percent or like maybe 10 to 20, 30% improvements?
That's a great question that I don't have an answer for.
I mean, I guess it depends on where we're starting because...
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Those things also depend on leg length. They depend on moment arm. There's other things that like ground contact time and the amount that we are able to lift our feet off the ground depends on. That's going to be different for everybody.
Yeah. And what can we say also about the biomechanics of the upper body, like the way we move our arms or how we relax our shoulders? Do they play a role in determining the running economy?
It has actually been found that our upper body mechanics don't really play a huge role in our overall running economy. It was thought that if we kind of twist more side to side, that we would be giving away too much energy to oscillating in ways other than forward. The only thing that was found to actually play a role is if we were to try our tie our hands behind our back and not use our arms at all. That is the only way that we could change our upper body mechanics that would have a detrimental effect on running economy. So I would suggest not trying to hold your hands behind your back the entire time. But other than that, it's really kind of recommended to just stick to your natural upper body mechanics. That's one thing that we don't really need to modify too much to change how we're running.
Yeah. Because I think it's interesting to notice how, you know, some people have a beautiful stride and they look like they're moving effortlessly. And we say that they have a really good running form, and other people have a terrible running form from the way
exactly.
it looks. But they might be, you know, equally efficient when running, or they are able to achieve, you know, the same level of performance as someone who runs really well. So I think there is always this, misunderstanding when looking at running economy, that it's not like running with a beautiful stride or a beautiful form, but actually being efficient while running. And
exactly, running with a form that works for you.
Yeah, we need to measure the cost of running and how much what is the cost of running and how it's influenced by our running economy, basically. So what's one way to do that?
To improve overall?
No, like to measure and to actually understand if we should change or do some kind of exercise to improve our running economy. And we will talk about these exercises, which have an influence on our running economy. Maybe it's like, I don't think it's something that we should always intentionally try to influence, but it's like the result of
I totally agree.
Exercising and just the fact that we are constantly adding miles and miles, and we just get more efficient at moving. But is there a way to quantify a running economy and maybe understand if we should really focus on it or not?
Sure. Yeah. So some of the articles that were sources for my article published on Free Trail talked about doing incremental volitional exhaustion exams and then comparing those to submaximal experiments. So the incremental volitional exhaustion tests were put somebody on a treadmill and increase their speed by 1 kilometer an hour every minute and have them just go until they feel like they need to stop. And what they were looking at in that study specifically was foot strike pattern, trying to see if there was a difference in running economy based on the self-selected foot strike pattern of that athlete. When it came to doing the incremental volitional exhaustion test, they didn't find any differences between running economy and the foot strike pattern that was selected by the athlete. When they finished that test, they moved on to doing the submaximal test. So they kept them for a specific amount of time at the same submaximal speed at a steady state, and again, looked at the foot strike pattern and the differences in running economy between the people who were doing different foot strike patterns. And they did find that there was a tendency for people who landed on their rear foot to be more economical overall, which mm-hmm. is a super interesting finding because most elite ultra runners typically do a 4 foot strike pattern.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, we're kind of looking at like, well, if this is more economical overall doing a rear foot, why do so many of the best do a 4 foot strike? And so that was one of the questions that I was asking myself. And what I came up with as to why that is because when we're using our forefoot to strike, we have to use more of our musculature to actually continue propelling ourselves forward. With a rear foot strike, we're using our footwear, depending on the heel drop of our shoes. We're using more of our skeletal bone structure to kind of absorb a lot of that impact. When we're striking with our forefoot, we're using more of our plantar flexors. We're using more of our intrinsic muscles of our feet. But the elite runners have higher mitochondrial density. They have better use of oxidative enzymes. Their physiological processes that allow their muscles to contract faster are more physiologically efficient than those who are not elite runners. And so they're not super concerned about not being able to use their muscles because their muscles are being able to be used more efficiently anyway.
Okay. So basically like the cost of running outweighs the benefit of
yes, exactly.
Less energy to do the same thing.
Right. Like yeah. there are some things that we're gonna do. We're not always gonna be able to hit all of the check that box and that box and that box of all of the things that typically have better running economy, because sometimes if we have something that's less economical, it can lead us to affect a different factor that is actually more economical, you know? So it's kind of the weighing the costs and benefits of all of the different variables.
Yeah. And also I think in the end, we shouldn't forget that the goal is always like trying to run faster. Like the race is won by whoever takes the least time to to get to the finish.
Exactly.
So regardless of the running economy. You know, it's about making mm-hmm. to the finish as quickly as possible. One question that I had, and this is all really interesting. I think most of the studies are based on road and track runners, but as trail runners, are there any special considerations considering the fact that we're often moving through technical terrain and that like no stride is equal to another? Due to mm-hmm. the unevenness of the terrain where we run, like how does the physiology takes this variability into account?
Right. I think a lot of studies are hard to conduct on that type of terrain that we're used to running on because you can't replicate it. Right. Yeah. So we're not going to put biomarkers on somebody and say, okay, go run however many miles or for however long at this exact speed on this terrain because you can't follow it. And so we have to kind of take that into account, like you just said, that a lot of these are road and track runners and these experiments are taking place on a treadmill in a controlled environment, where ultra running is not a controlled environment and it never will be. That's what's so beautiful about it, is that anything can happen and anybody can win, right? So this is really good information for training. And like you said, we don't always want to focus on changing our running economy necessarily or think too heavily about it. But it's a good thing to kind of keep in the back of our minds when we are training to at least maximize our running economy and maximize our efficiency when we're training on more controlled substances and more controlled surfaces, so that we can hopefully translate that as much as possible when we're out on the technical trail.
Exactly. I think this is a really good point. And another question that I had, so trail races or ultra races typically can last many, many hours or even days.
Mm-hmm.
So we may be moving at a very, very low speed.
Mm-hmm.
While, like, I think all this data or most of these data are collected at speeds that are more typical for middle distance or marathon runners. How does mm-hmm. running economy and biomechanics change with the pace? And considering the fact that, you know, in trail running, the pace is often quite low compared to maybe road running.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question too, is there's not a lot of research out there on ultra running. In the world of running, it's relatively new. So there's not a ton of research out there on it. And again, it's hard to do research on, like, imagine seeing an advertisement for a study that someone wants to conduct. They're like, hey, can I study you running for 20 hours? Yeah. Very few people are going to be willing to be participants in that study. So that's why it's so interesting to look at these things, is because there's not a lot of answers on them. And so that's why this research is so interesting, is because there's so much more to do and so much more to learn on it. And right now we're kind of just trying to transfer a little bit of this information into a whole new world where not all of it is going to be entirely transferable.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a really interesting question that you pose, especially with the slower paces. Like, the Moab 240 is going on right now. A lot of that is not going to be running, and it's on that technical terrain. And then you, again, take into account the delirium from lack of sleep and
yeah.
all these different things, nutrition, nutritional factors, things like that, that have nothing to do with running economy.
Yeah.
So it's these controllable factors, these modifiable variables that we can work on in training, that as long as we kind of nail these, we at least know we have something going for us. Whether we're, if we're not working on nutrition, if we're not working on that lack of sleep, delirium, at least we know we have good running economy.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of just working on what we can, modifying what we can, and getting better at the things that we know that we can get better at to take away those other variables and have less things that could go wrong for us.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's still interesting to look at these studies and research and try to extrapolate what maybe is useful to apply to ultra running, and
mm-hmm.
Try to, you know, to guess something and then go out running and try to pay attention to it to understand if our guess actually makes sense or not, even by just our experience. I know it's not science, it's not very scientific,
right?
But, you know, training is not just about science. There are so many things involved with training and running, and we should not forget that as well.
Like, I'm you're a runner too, you know, I'm sure you have good days and bad days, and they're not always explainable as to why we feel like
exactly.
we have a bad day. So
exactly, that's pretty much the same thing. Another question that I had after reading your article. So we all have our GPS or smartwatch, which often allow us to track variables like cadence or ground contact time or leg spring stiffness, which are all factors that can tell us something about our running economy. How should we interpret this data, and how can we better use this type of information to understand something about our running economy?
Sure. So like I said earlier, there's two different phases in our running gait. We have our stance time and our swing time. And ideally, that swing time is going to be longer than the stance time. The longer our foot is in the air and the shorter it is on the ground, the tendency is that that leads to a better running economy. And the ways to make that happen, to improve that, is again, to have a higher stride angle, to lift our foot further off the ground, have our knee drive higher, have a steeper angle when we're in the air. And again, the elite with that 4 foot strike has better muscular usage, and they're using the oxygen more efficiently to get their foot off the ground faster. So a way to improve that through training is not just through running and climbing up mountains, it's also through just regular strength training, through plyometrics, through jumps, through bounds, through strides, things like that, that are going to train our muscles to help get our feet off the ground faster. So that's going to shorten our ground contact time and lengthen our swing time, help us get our feet off the ground faster. And that will ultimately lead to a better running economy that way. So that's one way to kind of interpret that data, is we can see that percentage of time in those different phases of the gait cycle to see if they're 50-50, or if our feet are on the ground for longer than they are in the air. And if we see that, then there's things we can do to change that.
Yeah. Are there any numbers that we should aim for, or is it just a personal thing to address?
I think it's person to person. It'd be a case by case. As far as I'm aware, I haven't seen anything in my research that shows specific percentages.
Okay, so we can tell our audience it's useful to look at this data and to compare yourself in different sessions, different training, different parts of your preparation, as always. It's not just about running economy or biomechanics, but it's always useful to go through your training diary and try to understand as much as possible about the work you've done, how you run, and the work as you're doing. Okay, so we've understood that running economy is important. It's not the only important variable to pay attention to, but it's definitely something to keep in mind and maybe to address at some point in your training. Now we want to look at ways to improve our running economy through training. You already mentioned strength, plyometrics, just running, you know, running more volume and getting used to running at different speeds at race pace. I think it's really important to train at race pace in order to develop the ability to run more efficiently at that pace, for example. So can we get more in detail into that? And for example, give some examples of exercises and ways to improve our running economy through strength work, through plyometrics and such.
Of course, yeah. So like we were just talking about the plyometrics, they really help with mitochondrial density, usage of oxidative enzymes, and really just help overall improve our ability for those muscles to contract faster. And if our muscles can contract faster, our foot gets off the ground faster. And again, we decrease that ground contact time, increase that swing time. If we do kind of full body plyometrics and do what's called triple extension, which is an extension of the ankle, the knee, and the hip all at the same time. So imagine kind of a squat jump, right? So we're squatting and we jump all the way up.
Give a definition of plyometrics for people who maybe don't know or are not familiar with this type of strength work.
Sure. So a plyometric in basic terms is jumping.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about muscles, we are eccentrically contracting the muscle. So we're lengthening the muscle, getting it to its full length all the way, and then we're contracting it, shortening it very quickly. So think, again, a squat jump, if we're squatting all the way down to the ground, we're lengthening all of our muscles out. Our quads are lengthened because we're bending the knees, so they're at their full length, and then we're contracting them, shortening them by jumping all the way up, using them, getting into that triple extension position of the ankle, the knee, and the hip. And using that is going to help propel us forward in the long run by increasing our hip flexor strength. So it's going to help us with our stride angle. It's going to increase our ability of speed, getting our foot off the ground overall in time. Other ways to improve our running economy that have a little bit less to do with that biomechanical factor: heat training and altitude training.
Yep.
So when we're talking heat training, that ultimately increases our plasma volume in our blood, by, I believe it was 12%. So if we can increase our plasma volume by 12%, it's going to increase the amount of oxygen that comes out with every single beat of our heart. And if we are increasing that, that leads to our heart needing to pump out less blood on every beat or not having to beat as fast. And so it decreases the amount of work that our heart has to do overall while we're running, and we can keep a lower heart rate while running faster. So that's how that kind of improves that over time.
It's like an indirect way to influence your running economy.
Exactly. Talking about altitude training, that sounds like kind of a misleading term, because the most efficient way to do altitude training is actually to live at altitude and then train closer to sea level. So when we're living at altitude, we get the daily effects of living at altitude. Our body is getting more efficient at using less oxygen for all of our daily tasks, and we're getting accustomed and acclimatized to that. And then if we're training at sea level, we can really push ourselves a lot more because of all of those daily effects that we've gotten from living at altitude. So we can get more out of every single training session by training closer to sea level. Super interesting concept, is it used to be like live low, train high, like train at altitude, train at 9, 10, 11, 12,000 feet, get used to training there. But it's actually more efficient to live that high up and then train closer to sea level.
You actually feel a lot better also.
Yeah, exactly. It's weird. Like I live at 5,000 feet. It's not that high. Highest altitude I've ever lived at, though. So living at 5,000 feet, and then when I go back to visit my family in Southern California and train at sea level down there, it's like the air is so dense and there's so much oxygen to use. Yeah. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's so available.
So
super
easy.
Weird change.
Yeah, that's cool. Nice. I would like to go back a little bit on plyometrics and strength, because this is maybe the more accessible and easiest way to work on our running economy, because like heat training is not always possible. Altitude training, same, it's not for everyone. I think but even adding, rope jumps a couple of times a week or running drills,
right.
A skip, and like all those basic drills can really help us improve our running economy and improve our elastic return and tendon stiffness, which is what is connected with the cost of running and running economy. Is correct?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I didn't touch on it with the foot strike pattern, but there's also that option of midfoot striking. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit less research on midfoot striking. There's less people that are natural midfoot strikers. But the idea of landing on the midfoot is that you're using more of your arch to propel yourself forward, like the arch of your foot. And the arch of your foot kind of acts like a bow and arrow relief system, right? So when we're in that stance phase, we're storing up all that elastic energy in our foot, in our Achilles tendon. And when we're releasing it, like getting our foot off the ground, the arch of our foot is like that bow and arrow, releasing that arrow and propelling us forward. So like you just mentioned, that elastic energy is definitely plays a part in it for sure.
Yeah. And then just, you would suggest just general strength and core exercise to add to your weekly training routine?
Yeah, core is definitely important.
Probably more for injury prevention core. Than actually.
Exactly. It's more of like in sports, we call it prehab, right? So it's pre-rehabilitation. We're trying to make sure that we maintain something and do injury prevention rather than address it after we're already injured.
Yeah.
So core specifically, it's better for more like isometric stuff. Because we're trying to not do too much transverse plane, like rotational movements, because of that difference in oscillations. We want to kind of stay completely forward, because we want all of our motion to be going forward. So core definitely important for that. Weirdly enough, this is totally tangent. Myself, I've found that like my front shoulders get super sore after a long run from having my shoulders up, trying to balance going down technical trails or whatever. And so adding in a little bit of work just based on what you've found for yourself that you feel like you need to work on is never a bad thing.
Yeah. It's all about addressing your weaknesses and helping your body where maybe it's failing a little bit, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so we're approaching the winter season, and I believe it is a good time to start thinking about this concept and maybe apply some of the things that we mentioned in our training. Do you have any other consideration on how, because like during racing season or during the summer, we're maybe, you know, out on the trails, we're maybe doing many races or specific workouts, and there is not much time to think about running economy and other exercises, but maybe the winter time is the right time to think about all these things. Do you have any other considerations about periodizations or when to include these routines in our training?
Right. It's really easy in that winter season and our kind of racing off season to lose a lot of the fitness that we've gained over time, because it's snowing outside wherever we are, you know, so it's hard to get out there and make sure that we're really focusing on keeping ourselves fit. But a really good way to make sure that we're at least addressing something that we weren't addressing during that season is, again, doing the strength training and doing a lot of plyometrics and also rest. So especially in sports medicine and being an athlete myself, it's really difficult to take a rest day and tell ourselves that resting is just as productive on a day that you need it than anything else is on a day when you're exercising, because rest just doesn't feel like you're doing anything. But that's the point, right? Is to allow your body that time to recover and allow it to adapt to the new things that we're adding into our training, like these plyometrics. So if we're not used to doing squat jumps, jumping rope, leaps and bounds, strides, whatever else we're trying to do, like box jumps are really, really good ones. So standing on the ground and jumping up onto a box, and then a depth drop, jumping off of the box, landing in a squat and jumping back up. Those are all really great examples of plyometrics that we're probably not doing as much in racing season, that are a great way to keep up our fitness and really help that elasticity over time in the winter that our bodies are going to have to take time to adapt to. And so that's not something that needs to happen every day. That's a every other day, every third day type of thing, where it's okay, let's do a little bit of cross training. Let's add a rest day in here that I wouldn't typically, because it is the off season.
Yeah. So yeah, I think typically like twice a week, it's pretty safe. You don't get
absolutely
bored. It's usually sustainable, so it could be a good idea for the winter.
A good concept to remember is keep our high days high and our low days low.
Yeah.
Right. So if we're going for a speed workout or whatever, and race pace or tempo, do the plyometrics and do that strength workout that same day to keep all of that high volume load on that same day, and then take the next day or whatever your off day or rest day is and use that fully as a rest day for recovery.
Yeah, I've been doing that more often. Like I used to, you know, do my core and strength work on my recovery days. But now it's more like I either do them the day before a workout or the same days as a workout. So I put all the load just one day, and then I focus on recovery on the other day. And whether that's rest or cross training or easy running, I don't have to think about anything else. And I think both physically and mentally, it's a good change.
But yeah, definitely. Again, it's tough to do, because you're like, I don't want to rest. I'm not doing anything. But it's really important to allow your body to take that time to adapt overnight.
Yeah. And again, I wanted to point out it's not a rule, but it's something that maybe people could try and understand how they respond. In the end, I think training is about making smart choices and understanding what is right for you. So trying a few changes, it's key, and maybe can lead us to an improvement in one area or just in our.
Yeah, and speaking of changes, you were asking earlier of things that we can do to try to improve our running economy overall, kind of bringing it back to that.
Yep.
When we're talking about the foot strike pattern, with the tendency of rear foot to be more economical and the tendency of forefoot to be less economical but more common in the elite, something that's really interesting is that people who do a forefoot strike can switch between a forefoot and rear foot strike and do either one they want without losing any running economy.
Okay.
If a habitual rear foot striker tries to switch to a 4 foot strike, it is typical that they will get worse running economy immediately when they first try to switch to that 4 foot strike. And my thinking on that is that because, you know, we're talking about all this musculature and oxidative enzyme usage, people who do a rear foot strike don't have that built up because they haven't been using that over time. They haven't been using the plantar flexors and the muscles in the arch of their feet because we're using so much of that footwear and that skeletal structure to take a lot of that impact. And so if a rear foot striker is considering changing to a 4 foot strike, I would definitely recommend focusing on those plyometrics first, you know, kind of building up that efficient musculature use, building up that oxidative enzyme use to be able to switch to a 4 foot strike without losing any of their running economy.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And finally, maybe what can we say about shoes? I'm thinking about, you know, the super shoes that are sold for road and track running.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the original Vaporfly, they advertised that you're by wearing the Vaporfly, you could improve your running economy by 4%. So apparently there is
right.
gain that we can get from shoes, even if it's 4%, 2%, whatever. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
But how does that
sort of percent.
How does the choice of our shoe influence our running economy, in particular, of course, on trails?
So I've tried the Vaporfly actually, just on a treadmill, but the feeling is so interesting compared to any other road shoe and a trail shoe specifically, because it has that carbon plate, it
yeah.
propels you forward without you really having to do a lot of the work.
Yeah.
So that was my first time experiencing that type of shoe. So it's a really interesting feeling. But for me, footwear is very much find what is comfortable for you, find what works for you, what is, sometimes it's hard to find that balance between the perfect drop, the perfect amount of cushion, and the perfect amount of kind of like tactility underneath your feet to where you can feel where your feet are like on the trail.
Yep.
Right. So if you have max cushion, it can be hard to feel the rocks beneath you. But
yep.
if you feel too many rocks beneath you, then your feet are going to be bruised afterwards. It just, footwear has always been so particular person to person. I would say in general, for people that are rear foot strikers, a little bit more of a heel drop is going to be more beneficial.
Okay.
Because if we have that drop, if we have a little bit of a rocker plate in that shoe, then it's going to help propel us forward. Kind of similar idea to that carbon plate is that we're going to land on our heel. It's going to help roll us forward. And it's going to take a little bit of that strain off of our muscles. And we're using that footwear. We're using our bone structure. For people that are 4 foot strikers and use their muscles a lot anyway and don't like landing on their heel, are not going to need as much cushion underneath their heel because they're not going to land on it anyway. You know, so if we're not landing on the heel anyway, we don't want to be lugging around more shoe than is necessary. Have something a little bit lighter on your feet to kind of help you propel forward faster that way. So it depends heavily on your foot strike, heavily on, me personally, injury history, you know, what's more comfortable for you to have on your feet. I'm also a very big proponent of once you find a shoe that works, stick with it until it stops working. You know, so load up on a couple pairs of what you're comfortable with. And once you kind of get enough miles on those where they're totally dead and you have to find something new, but don't choose footwear lightly. You know, find what works for you and ride that way until it stops working.
Yeah, I agree. The shoe choice is always a balance game. Like it's always a compromise because there are always so many
mm-hmm.
factors, and there will ever, like, there will never be a perfect shoe for
mm-hmm.
any kind of race, any kind of terrain, because trail running is so variable. So
right,
yeah, again, the choice is personal. I was just interested in understanding whether there is a shoe model or a choice that is more or less beneficial from a biomechanic or running economy standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Of course,
yeah,
I think
the
like the lighter the better,
that,
but
right.
as long as we don't get injured or we
right.
don't compromise too much on, you know, cushion and comfort and all those things.
You want your barefoot to be comfortable, but not so comfortable to where you don't want to run. You want to just enjoy the shoe, right? So it's kind of just like, what's going to make us run faster? What's going to help us propel forward? And again, it's such a personal choice.
Yeah.
So there's not too many factors that really play a part in footwear, unless, again, there's an injury history, unless there's something that you're worried about. But like you said, trail running is so variable and our surfaces are so variable that having something a little bit lighter and a little bit closer to the ground overall is really helpful when the trails are more technical. But other than that, it's kind of up to the person.
I agree. Lauren, thank you so much. And I hope our audience enjoyed today's conversation. I thought it was really interesting, and hopefully we'll learn something, and we will start asking ourselves some questions when we're out running, not because we need to doubt about ourselves, but because learning and thinking can lead to improvement. And this is a good perspective that I like to look at training and the science of running in general. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you reaching out.
Yeah. Thank you so much for listening to our great interview today. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting us with a rating and a review in your podcast player, or by sharing it on social media, tagging me and Vertron. We would really appreciate that. If you haven't already downloaded the Vertron app, I encourage you to do so. There, you can connect for free with our trail runners of all levels in the Vertrun community in our in-app groups. You can stay in trail shape with our free workout videos and get affordable coaching for your next trail running goal for only $25 a month. Thanks again for being here today. Until next time, I'm Francesco Puppi. Thank you for listening to Running Long.